Hello, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, part of the New Books Network. I am Astrid Counti. Today I will be speaking with Dr. Frank Salimé, who is currently an assistant professor of Near Eastern Studies at Boston College and the Department of Slavic and Eastern Languages. He has written a book, Language, Memory, and Identity in the Middle East, The Case for Lebanon. This book is an attempt to bring back to the fore of Middle East studies the issue of language as a key factor in shaping and misshaping the region, with the hope of rediscovering a broader, more honest, and less ideologically tainted discussion on the Middle East. Language, Memory, and Identity in the Middle East has a special focus on Lebanon, a Christian homeland, because Lebanon has traditionally acted as the region's template for change and a barometer gauging its problems and charting its progress.
Dr. Salimé, thank you for being on the New Books Network, New Books in Anthropology podcast. Today we're going to be talking about your book, Language, Memory, and Identity in the Middle East, The Case for Lebanon. But first, I wanted to ask you some questions about your academic history and how you got to the point of where you are now. You're an assistant professor at Boston College, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, I'm a student of history. I was formed as a historian. And my area of specialty is the modern Middle East. More specifically, I work on the time period between 1918 and 1936. I mean, this is my area of specialty, of course. I deal with issues, periods, events, peoples, both before and after this period. I dealt essentially, as I was being formed as a historian, I dealt with the history of minorities in the Middle East during the Mandate period, and to be exact, the French Mandate period. So I dealt with the areas that eventually became Syria and Lebanon. During the times I was studying in the region, there were no countries called Syria and Lebanon, and there were essentially five states that the French inherited from the Ottomans, and those were the states of Greater Lebanon, the state of the Alawite Mountain, the state of the Druze Mountain, Aleppo, and Damascus, those states that the French mandatory authorities had inherited actually from the Ottomans. When the Ottoman Empire broke up at the end of World War I, what the French inherited were the administrative units that formed that part of the Ottoman dominion in the Levant. So my area of interest was minorities, non-Arab, non-Muslim minorities in the Levantine region.
Okay.
And branched out in later years and began focusing more specifically on the what became the Republic of Lebanon and the Syrian Arab Republic in 1936.
Okay. One of the questions that I did have concerning your book was why you chose Lebanon as a case study to talk about language, memory, and identity.
Well, you know, studying the Levant and studying minorities in the Levant and the mosaics of people that constitute the Levantine region of East Lebanon stands out as a very interesting case study because it's a very small country inhabited by a multitude of people of about 18-19 distinct groups in Lebanon, often referred to as confessions, but they're in essence ethno-religious groups, ethnic groups defined religiously, defined by way of religious nomenclature. So Lebanon stands out because of its size. It's very tiny. It's about the size of Connecticut, to put it in American terms. But it's inhabited by 18 different ethnic groups, if you will. Syria is the next the next area of interest. It's much larger than Lebanon, population-wise and geographically speaking. There's about 21 million Syrians. There's about 3.5-4 million Lebanese. And pretty similar to Lebanon, Syria is also an ethnic or ethno-religious mosaic. But it's on a somewhat larger scale. So Lebanon was naturally important to me because of its size and because of the severity of its diversity. I do also have a personal history with Lebanon. I was born and raised in Lebanon. I came to place. I was a teenager. I came to go to college in the state. So there was. I was also personally interested in the Lebanese experiment, and that's why I decided to focus on it early in my studies.
What prompted your inspiration to write a book like this, where you're discussing the cultural identity and its relation to language, especially in the Middle East? And I also wanted to ask you, what is the Middle East? Because I know that in the Western world, especially in America, there's just sweeping statements made about the Arab world and the Middle East. But what really is the Middle East? And then can you talk a little more about why you wrote a book like this?
That's it. It's a very good question. What is the Middle East? Very difficult to define the Middle East. But at the same time, the term Middle East is, I would argue, an ideologically neutral term, and therefore, in a lot of ways, a satisfying term, because when you begin conflating Middle East with Arab world, this is when we begin encountering problems, because the Middle East is certainly not the Arab world, it is not the Muslim world, it is certainly inhabited by majorities of Arabs and Muslims, but it's much more than that. And that's what I attempted to do in my research and in my book, and that is to show a different facet of the Middle East, that that the Middle East is not the monolith that we are made to perceive, that it is much more than simply the Arab world or simply the Muslim world, but it's actually a mosaic of different different ethnicities, different histories, different narratives, where the Arab and Arabist narrative might be a dominant one, but it's not the only one. So what I'm attempting to do is to show a different face, a different interpretation of the Middle East as a diverse hybrid of ethnicities and languages and histories and memories and religious groups and so forth.
And how do you feel that the cultural identity and the language are related? Because you talk a lot about that very deeply throughout your book.
You know, part of the problem when you begin broaching questions pertaining to identity in the East is that we are hardwired in the West to look at ourselves and at the world about us in terms of language. Mm-hmm. So this incidentally is not a modern phenomenon. It goes back to the ancient Greeks, you know, Greeks and barbarians. So everybody who spoke Greek was Greek. The rest are barbarians. By the same token, when we look at the world today, we look at it in terms of, and I'm talking cultural identities here, we look at it in terms of language. And usually we use the same set of cognate words in reference to identity, to ethnicity, to language, to territory. So a Swede is a person who lives in Sweden, who speaks Swedish, etc. And so we have sort of migrated this attitude, this perception of ourselves to the Middle East, and we have constructed models, narratives, paradigms of the Middle East based on the idea that Arabic is the dominant language in the Middle East, and therefore all the peoples inhabiting the Middle East are Arabs. This, incidentally, has been the case for about 5,000 years of recorded history in the Middle East, where people spoke world languages, if you will, imperial languages, but were not necessarily part of that imperial lot. So for upwards of 2,000 years, the bulk of Middle Easterners spoke Sumerian, a very ancient language that has not survived into modern times in any fashion as a spoken language. So both Sumerians and non-Sumerians spoke Sumerian, because that was the dominant culture of dominant language of civilization, the dominant language of empire. With the extinction, if you will, of the Sumerians and their civilization came the Aramaeans, and you had peoples from Aramaeans to others. The Hebrews, for instance, spoke Aramaic, but weren't Aramaeans. And so on and so forth. So what I'm trying to get at is that there is an imbrication of cultures and civilizations in the Middle East that came and went, that brought with them their linguistic habits, imposed them on Middle Easterners, or had Middle Easterners adopt them, if you will, and have them use those languages without those Middle Easterners, necessarily feeling that they were part of that ethnos that made use of those languages. So you had Greeks, you had Latins, Romans. I mean, one example that I like to use is to sort of vulgarize that model is a scene. Actually, I use it in one of my classes. Are you familiar with the movie The Passion of the Christ?
Yeah.
Okay. Anything that struck you in that movie? I don't know if you've seen it.
Yes, I did see it. One thing I was surprised with was it seemed like they were trying to be accurate with Jesus speaking Aramaic, speaking other languages sometimes, depending upon who he was talking to.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus was not unique in that the end of his times. I mean, he was your typical native of the Eastern Mediterranean. He happened to be a Jew. He spoke Aramaic. Aramaic is what his daily language. It was the language of Jewish commoners, if you will. So he spoke Aramaic. He spoke it was his native language.
Mm-hmm.
To his jailers, he spoke in Greek because his jailers were soldiers, and one of the language of the masses at the time was Greek, because the Romans came and replaced the Greeks who preceded them with a Roman governor. He spoke Latin because that was the language of administration. And in the temple, he spoke the holy language of the Jewish people, which was biblical Hebrew. So he was not special. He was not unique. He was a child of his times, and he's very much similar to modern Middle Easterners. In the case of Jesus, it is assumed that he came from a priestly family, so one might assume that he was educated. But most uneducated, I would say illiterate Middle Easterners, are able to function in multiple languages. And that is precisely due to their place in the world as a crossroads of civilizations and languages and ethnicities, and the fact that they live in an area that, geographically speaking, has witnessed an imbrication, a succession of different cultures that have left their linguistic and other cultural markings on the region.
I see. So you're saying that essentially in the Middle East, language is not necessarily going to be inextricably linked to your cultural identity like how we see it in the West.
Exactly.
Because you could be speaking different languages.
This is one issue. This is one problem of my encounter in references to the Middle East as the Arab world, that is assuming that people are defined linguistically by way of the Arabic language.
Yes.
Another problem is the fact that Arabic, unlike many living languages, many spoken languages, many languages that one uses extemporaneously, natively spoken languages, Arabic is not a natively spoken language. And I would, you know, take that argument further and say that not only is it not used natively, Arabic is nobody's natively spoken language. Arabic is a cultic, ceremonial language, a literary language, it's a liturgical language, but it is not spoken natively. What people speak throughout the Middle East are bevies of languages that are generally referred to as Arabic, but are as different and distinct from Arabic as English is or French is, but I would say also English is distinct and different from Latin. So on the one hand, you have Latin your own context. You have Latin as the cultic language or literary language, if you will. And you have Romance languages and English that are the natively spoken languages of commoners and educated people at once. So in medieval Europe, one spoke their native dialect. They were called dialects at the time. They could have been dialects of French, dialects of what later became Italian, dialects of Portuguese, and so forth. And when they went to school, they studied Latin, the language that was written, the language of culture at the time, the language of literature, and so forth. That is exactly the situation in today's Middle East. So native Middle Easterners, depending on where they are, in the Middle East, are born and grow up speaking distinct languages that are their native languages. And if they have to go to school, they learn what we commonly refer to as Arabic. So what we commonly refer to as Arabic is a learned language. It is not a language that one acquires spontaneously, that one acquires that one could refer to as a maternal language, langue maternelle, as they say in French. It is so in a sense, Arabic is nobody's langue maternelle, nobody's maternal language.
So it's not like a vernacular language that everyone who says they speak Arabic would actually be able to speak and understand the same way.
Correct.
And I do remember you saying in your book that there's a modern standard Arabic, that's what you called it, and that was more like Quranic Arabic, like Arabic that was used by the educated and by the elite, which I found that to be really interesting because we don't really hear that distinction about what it means to speak Arabic or to be Arab, that there is all these different variations of how that is happening in different countries and different areas. And I wanted you to talk a little more about how that modern standard Arabic is related to or not related to a regular person, like a person in Lebanon, and why that may or may not be a part of their identity.
Well, I would argue that all of these languages are part of people's identity. I mean, the part of people's heritage. heritage is not something for one to cherry pick, to pick and choose and say, okay, this is part of it. The whole thing is part of their heritage. The problems that some people in the Middle East, especially minorities, who deem themselves different from the Arabs, the problems that they have is being pigeonholed as Arabs on account of their use of the Arabic language. With regards to modern standard Arabic, modern standard Arabic is, if you will, a modern version of classical Arabic, what is commonly referred to as classical Arabic or Quranic Arabic. So, to put it in English terms, modern standard Arabic would be modern American English to the English of Char, if you will. So that for somebody who is not versed in the English of Chaucer, modern standard Arabic might modern standard Arabic might pose some problems. To me, for instance, as somebody who learned English as an adult, I cannot read Chaucer without a dictionary. So to me, there is some difficulty between the Chaucer English and the modern standard American English. So people who are versed in Quranic Arabic or in classical Arabic might have some issues with modern standard Arabic. But with regards with the dialectal forms, what we commonly refer to as dialects of Arabic, there is a very wide difference between modern standard Arabic and the spoken languages. As I said before, if you go to school and get a formal formation in modern standard Arabic, it is a completely alien language to you. Of course, that doesn't mean that in the spoken dialects there are no Arabic vocabulary. For instance, there's a wealth of Arabic vocabulary in the spoken variants, the dialectal variants, the demotics, the spoken demotics in the Middle East. But there's a wealth of vocabulary also comes from Greek, from Latin, from Turkish, from French, and so forth. So the spoken dialects of the Middle East, depending on where you are, can have a substrat that comes from Aramaic, that comes from Syriac, that comes even from Hebrew, and the abstract, that is the vocabulary of the languages, can come from anywhere, and certainly Arabic has made big contributions to the vocabulary of the spoken dialects. But there are groups in modern-day Lebanon, in modern-day Syria, in modern-day Iraq that make the argument that their spoken languages cannot be referred to as Arabic without sort of oversimplifying the situation. And I'm talking about linguists here who make the argument that those dialects are languages in their own right and should not be dismissed as dialects and should begin being referred to as bona fide languages.
So I have a question about the assumed uniformity of the Middle East in general, and what you think that assumption has, or how that role the assumption has played in studying the Middle East and the West.
Well, I make the argument in the book that part of the reason we are unable to get to the bottom of the issues, the problems, the volatility in the Middle East is our instinct in looking at it as this monolith. I think this is an absolute paradigm, looking at the Middle East as the Arab world or the Islamic world or what have you. We need to begin validating I'm not talking about dismissing the Arabist narrative of the Middle East. There are bona fide Arabs in the Middle East. There are the dominant culture in the Middle East, and they should certainly be given precedence, if you will, but minority narratives in the Middle East should be valorized, should be given some attention, should be looked at, and we should start looking at the Middle East as the mosaic that it is, as this hybrid of identities that it is, and stop looking at it in sort of monistic terminologies of Arab worlds or Muslim worlds or Arab Muslim worlds and so forth. And that's why I am, for instance, a very strong proponent of the term Middle East, even though it is it's kind of neutral, it's tasteless, odorless, if you will, but it's accurate.
So with your book, you did talk about how you don't want to dismiss any previous approaches, but you wanted to add to the conversation a new approach. What is this new approach that you're hoping to add to the conversation? And what kind of impression are you hoping this book will leave on readers?
I mean, look, we are dealing with a major issue in Syria today. There's a civil war raging in Syria. Analysts, people invested in the history and well-being of the Syrian people go on speaking in terms of these obsolete paradigms of Syria as this unitary, unified, coherent, cohesive state. When in reality, Syria is a mosaic of ethnicities, linguistic groups, cultural groups, religious groups that were forced to live together, and they have led this uneasy existence for the past 70, 80 years or so. So I think it would be very useful for us to look at history, the history of Syria prior to 1936, where there was nothing called Syria. There was no people who referred to themselves as Syrians or felt that they were somehow Syrians, but were a collection of ethnicities and ethno-religious groups and cultural groups and religious groups that had different nomenclatures in referring to themselves. So when we approach Syria, I think it would be helpful to look at this history and look at the diversity of Syria and say that, okay, there might be a different narrative that we can draw lessons from, a different model that we can draw lessons from, and say that we don't have to think in terms of this united Syria, that perhaps, a Syria that is composed of different cantons, of an Alawite mountain that is an autonomous administrative unit or an autonomous state, if you will, or a Druze autonomous unit or a Sunni autonomous unit in Damascus or a Christian autonomous unit in Aleppo or a Kurdish autonomous unit and so on and so forth. So this is not a prescription that I'm making. This is a return to the past, drawing lessons from the past, looking at the map of a mere 80 years ago, what Syria 80 years ago looked like. So it would really be helpful to look at the history when we start sort of plotting or charting the future of Syria. And Syria is one example, the entire Middle East. I would limit myself to the Levantine region of the Middle East, and that would include modern-day Lebanon, modern-day Israel, and parts of certainly modern-day Syria and parts of modern-day Jordan.
Okay. Well, we're winding down to the end of the interview, so I wanted to ask you, what projects are you working on now, and what's the next things that you're going to be writing about?
I am actually, right now, I'm in Paris. I'm working in the Foreign Ministry archives, and I have just returned from a very short trip to Lebanon, and work in Lebanon on a private archive of a early 20th century Lebanese businessman, intellectual, and author. So I'm in the process of writing modern history of Lebanon and Syria through these private archives, the archives and private correspondence of this Lebanese author. So it's at the same time a biography, but it's also a history. To give you a very brief example, this fellow that I'm writing, whose archive I'm mining, his name is Charles Quorum. He was a Francophone poet in Lebanon. He wrote the bulk of his literary output was between 1919 and 1958-1960. He was born in 1894. He died in 1963. Prior to becoming a poet, he was a business tycoon. He was a visionary in business before he became sort of this inspired poet, if you will. In 1911, he graduated high school and traveled to the United States. He was 17. He was barely 17 years old. And he opened a concession store on Broadway Avenue. And I mentioned earlier, he was a Francophone. He became a Francophone poet. So his intellectual language was French. His language of education was French. He was French educated. But he spent about a year on Broadway Avenue in New York, and he attended the same Broadway shows night after night for about a year, and that's how he learned English. So during his stay in the United States, he met Henry Ford, and I should mention again that he was a teenager. He met Henry Ford, and he got a promise from Henry Ford around 1911-1912 that he would be the exclusive agent of Ford Motor Cars in the Levant. And do I have time to tell the story?
Sure. Go ahead.
So this fellow, Charles Quorum, for about 20 days to a month, he would go to Henry Ford's office and he would sit in front of his secretary the whole day, waiting for an audience with this great American industrialist. At the end of the day, he would get kicked out. Towards the end of the month, I don't know if the secretary felt sorry for him, was really infatuated, impressed by his persistence. She granted him this audience with Henry Ford. And Charles Quorum goes and meets with Henry Ford and tells him, essentially, gets straight to the chase, and he says, I want to be the exclusive agent of Ford Motor Cars in Lebanon. So Henry Ford asks him, where is Lebanon? We're talking 1911, 1912. As I said earlier, there was nothing called Lebanon, nothing called Syria at that time. Mm-hmm. So this kid points to a globe, a map on Henry Ford's desk, points to an area that was at the time Mount Lebanon, and he tells him, this is Lebanon. Henry Ford says, son, do you have roads in Lebanon? Charles Quorum says, you give me the cars and I'll build the roads. And, the rest, as they say, is history. And essentially, this Charles Quorum, by 1920, began importing Ford cars into Lebanon in a country that barely existed at the time, that certainly did not have an infrastructure for those vehicles. And so what I'm reading, the archive that I'm reading now, is actually the history of Lebanon through the importation of Ford motor cars to Lebanon, because with the cars came the roads, and not only the roads. I mean, you see documents that this businessman, Charles Quorum, sort of musing about the fact that, you know, he's opening a dealership in, say, Tripoli, Lebanon. Tripoli, the area where he's building the dealership, has he has no access to that area. There are no roads. There are no pharmacies, no restaurants for his employees, no homes. So with the sort of movement of the cars into that area of northern Lebanon, he built roads, he built bridges, he built homes, he built pharmacies, restaurants, grocery stores, and so forth. So that's in a nutshell what I'm working on, the sort of history of modern Lebanon and Syria and Palestine, what later became Israel in 1948, through the propagation, the building of these various dealerships, Ford car dealerships. And I should add here that the region that I'm interested in was under French mandate, so the natural impulse would be to have, if you were to have cars, would be to have French cars. But by 1946, about 45% of the vehicles in Lebanon and Syria were Ford cars. So that should give you an idea about what this guy was doing at the time.
Sounds really interesting. I wonder if that be finished when you plan on publishing it.
Well, I've just begun to scratch the surface. I've done about 5% of the work. I expect to do some work here in the French Foreign Ministry archives for the next 3 weeks. I return to the States early August, and I expect to return to Lebanon and France later in the year through 2012-2013, and I hope that the book will be finished in 2013.
Okay. Well, Dr. Frank Salome, thank you very much for being on this podcast today. Once again, the book is Language, Memory, and Identity in the Middle East, The Case for Lebanon. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Astrid. I appreciate the time and your patience.
This has been Astrid County for New Books in Anthropology, part of the New Books Network. I've been speaking with Dr. Frank Salome about his book, Language, Memory, and Identity in the Middle East, The Case for Lebanon. It is available now via Lexington Books, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Roman and Littlefield Publishing Group, Incorporated. Thanks for listening.